Continuing the interview with Alexander Wilson on November 22nd, 1996. Okay, so you walked into...
Yeah, Jack may have been with me, may have not been with me. I'm a little unclear on that. But we walked into Botha's office.
In Pretoria? Where?
Oh.
No. Johannesburg?
I'm not sure. Pretoria is a seat of the government, but it seemed like we were... Maybe the government also had... they sat in... what's the town in the south?
Cape Town?
Cape Town. I don't know where we were.
Anyway.
Pretoria, probably.
But you already had a meeting scheduled with them.
Are you going? Is it taking?
Yeah, we're fine. We're fine.
So I walked into Botha's office and he took off after him. Carter and Andrew Young and Americans in general. And boy, was he beside himself. And he just launched into a monologue. It was most distressing.
Blamed you for it all.
Well, finally, I interrupted him and said, you know, Mr. Prime Minister, we're Americans and we're just not in a position to criticize our own government. When we're in a foreign country, something like that. I think I said, well, if we weren't, you know, I would agree with you, but we shouldn't be talking like this. So he got up and went on the floor for something and came back and I had mentioned that I was going hunting in Zambia, and boy, that really turned him on. He talked about elephant hunting and all sorts of things. We got along well. But he was sure mad.
Why were you going to see him in the first place?
Courtesy. And you know, if you're considering making an investment in a foreign country, you better make yourself known to the top politicians. Establish some sort of a rapport with them so you can get to see them when you have to. And that's what I was doing, just laying the groundwork for what might occur in the future.
Well, I'm just thinking you must have had some presence, considerable presence in the country already, or you can't just call up and say, I want to talk to the Prime Minister.
No, I think we may have used the General Electric Company presence in Australia to get that appointment. But you know, the head of a foreign government, you know, if will talk to the representatives of companies who have a prospect of investing in their country, it's not hard to get to see them.
They have an interest.
They have an interest in foreign investment. They have an interest in sizing you up as well as you have in sizing them up. So, I've not found it difficult to, in those days, to meet with these fellows.
Did you do the same thing in Rhodesia?
Yeah. Indonesia. think almost every place we work.
Mm-hmm. You've met with a lot of heads of state then.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting to look, you know, and I met with a lot of politicians who were backbenchers at the time. Bev and I were remarking last night as we watched, night before last, as we watched the Prime Minister of Australia and the President of the United States before a press conference. Did you see that?
No, I didn't.
Prime Minister of Australia is John Howard. John Howard was a Victoria, state of Victoria politician when we knew him. And we used to see a lot of him.
Wow.
So I told Bev it was kind of interesting to see these fellows who
are
now big shots that you knew when they were little shots.
Mm-hmm.
Fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We had a coal deposit in Indonesia. And we had a dickens of a time getting approval of the Indonesian government. I think it took us something like 7 years to work that deal, because everybody wanted to pay off. You know, from the federal politicians to the locals. And we weren't going to pay off anybody. And it took that long for us to convince these folks that an American company like ours wasn't going to pay off. I couldn't understand how Freeport, for instance, got their deal off the ground pretty easily. Alcoa was in there. And I guess they, somehow or another, they found a way to do it. But took us a long time. But in the interim, I would go to Australia. Keith Wallace would make, I mean to Indonesia. Keith would get up there and he would talk, and I'd go and I'd talk, and we had our own folks or geologists in an office in Jakarta. And one of these meetings that I had arranged for me was to meet with Adam Malik. Adam Malik was the vice president of Indonesia and head of the, I've forgotten what they call it, but anyway, head of the energy department.
What was the name?
Adam Malik, M-A-L-I-K.
Okay, right.
And we met in his home. And I was ushered into his living room, just in the front row, was a huge case, glass case, with a tiger mounted in his living room. So when we got through, talking business, I remarked on the tiger and told him how interested I was in hunting, and I had just returned from a hunting trip to Africa, and that I wish I had had the opportunity to hunt in India before it was no longer possible to collect tigers. He said, "Oh, no problem." He said, "Let's go tiger hunting." He said, "You come with me." And I said, "Mr. Malik, how do you hunt the tigers?" "Oh," he said, it's really very simple. He said, when we set the date, I will call the general who is in charge of Sumatra, and he will tell his troops to tell all the villagers to be on the lookout for tiger. They'll spot a tiger, they'll radio me, we'll get on a helicopter, we'll go to Sumatra. Now we'll fly to Sumatra, we'll then get on the helicopter. Oh, they identify the tiger. The army will surround it. And then you and I will fly to Sumatra, we'll get on a helicopter, we'll sit on, we'll shoot the tiger.
Oh my.
That didn't sound very sporting to me. So I never took him up on his invitation, but that's the way Mr. Malik shot his tigers.
Oh. So you didn't get a Sumatran tiger?
No. No, I wouldn't have it anyway. You know, that's too few tigers left in the world to go out and shoot them. But I had a lot of fun, you know, at times with these guys. Strange things happen.
We haven't talked about your hunting. When did you take that up?
Well, my granddad bought me my first .22 when I was age 12. I guess that's what started. I had an opportunity to do a good deal of hunting when we became involved in Wyoming, you know, back in the late 50s.
What were you hunting?
Deer and elk. And I shot a lot of them. Had a good time. But I've liked to hunt all my life. And either big game hunting or bird shooting. And I took the first trip to Africa in 1981 with Jack Parker. And then I followed in 82, I went back to the same place with Bev. 83, I went to Tanzania. I went back every year for 8 years, I guess it was.
Where did you go with Parker?
Zambia.
Zambia. And then Tanzania.
Yeah, then I found elephant hunting in Tanzania. Found that you could go and it's in an environment where I felt comfortable taking Bev.
Did she hunt as well?
No, Bev never shot. She didn't, but she was out with me every step of the way. She didn't stay in camp until she became so allergic to tsetse fly bites that she had to could no longer go back to tsetse fly country in Africa. We were on a camp on a river in the Salu Game Reserve. And Bev got edema. Her arms and feet and hands and ears and face swelled. She was in terrible shape. Got sick, and fortunately the professional hunter had prednisone. And he gave her prednisone.
That's an elephant gun.
When we came home, our doctor said it was damn lucky that he had prednisone, had the presence of mind to give it to her. That not only were her extremities swelling, but her brain was swelling. And that it's brain swelling that kills people in the environment. So she can't go back to tsetse fly country.
No.
So I started hunting. I take my kids with me. And we took. Well, Bev was with me when Christy and her husband John with us, then we took I guess Steve and Shelley made the first trip with us, then Christy and John, then Lexi made two trips and Steve made another trip with me. But I had fun. I got in on the last of the elephant sport hunting in Africa.
You've got an elephant foot right here.
Yeah, got them all over.
Waste baskets.
Yeah. Well, that was fun.
How did you get around the, I mean, where?
The car.
How was that arranged? There was some, were you in reserves where you were?
Oh, the outfitter in Tanzania is a man named Gerard Passanisi, who was French, who had a very large hunting concession in what is called the Salu Game Reserve. The Salu Game Reserve is a place in southern Tanzania on the Mozambique border that under the German rule of what was then called Tanganyika was set up, devoted to wildlife. No native entry was allowed. And the Emperor of Germany gave Empress, whatever her name was, the Salu Game Reserve for her wedding present. And it's a terrible tsetse-fly country, so you know the locals have to bring their cows in to survive, and when they can't, these tsetse-fly areas, the tsetse-fly will kill a domestic animal within about 4 days, and horse, cow, dog, whatever it is. And the local game has an immunity to the tsetse-fly. So it's only in tsetse-fly areas in Africa where you find no people.
Hmm.
And that's where we hunt it.
And you've got elephants and cheetah?
Well, that's a leopard.
Is that a leopard?
Yeah. Well, my hunting out there, I've collected 7 bald elephants. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 leopards. And a whole bunch of other stuff. Buffalo. I love to shoot the Cape Buffalo. Mm-hmm. That was fun.
They're monstrous things, aren't they?
Mm-hmm.
And you fished as well.
Yep, often as I could.
Mm-hmm. Did you do this in connection with?
Yeah, I did so much fishing and everybody knew about it. Somebody in the Utah board chuckled one day and said, "Wilson will not take us any place where there's no fish."
Fish come first and then the minerals.
Yeah.
Did you find this was a...
Find what?
I was wondering if you often found this as a nice icebreaker with the people in these countries.
Well, you mean hunting?
You're hunting.
Oh, yeah, it was. But not much hunting and fishing in Australia.
No?
No.
Did you go kangaroo hunting?
I shot one kangaroo and I decided I'd never shoot another one.
Why?
Terrible. Oh, I don't know. He looks so damn pitiful when he's on the ground.
I wanted to talk about your hunting because that's been a major interest, I know.
Still is.
Uh-huh.
I think if I can talk Bev into it, I'll go back to Africa.
Mm-hmm.
In 87, I'll be 76 then. I think I owe myself one more trip.
One more? Oh, you'll always think you can do one more. I think. Is there anything more that you would like to say about GE then?
Yeah, I think we have a whole session on General Electric Company.
We need GE, of course, BHP, and also we haven't gotten into the environmental movement at all, which started in the 70s.
Well, we can talk about that.
That was going parallel too.
Yeah.
So.
But I think this GE, BHP involvement is gonna take another session.
Yeah, oh yes, definitely. I'm just kind of trying to, I think maybe we're about ready to wind up here.
I think so.
All right, and then we'll continue with GE, BHP, environmentalists, and.
You know, I really don't have much to say about the environmentalists. We had difficulty, one environmentalist first raised the issue. We had some difficulty out in Navajo Mine.
Mm-hmm.
We worked out a probably had to work it through the state environmental department, but we would level the spoil piles and reseed them, and you know, the problem went away. We raised better grass on the spoil piles than they had elsewhere in the Navajo Reservation.
Mm-hmm.
It never became an unmanageable problem for us. We had mine and waste rehabilitation to deal with, and it was technically feasible. It was simply an economic problem. If you couldn't afford to do it, you didn't do it. I mean, you didn't open the mine. Thank goodness we got out of the uranium business before it became a problem there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the company that bought our uranium business was Kojima. Kojima was a French commercial uranium firm.
How is that spelled?
C-O-G-E-M-A, and it's a Ben DeMoss became president of Kojima. Ian Ritchie was the man, was the operating person. But they're still, I believe they're still putting topsoil on top of the uranium tailings ponds. It's an expense to them.
Mm-hmm. Has to be taken into account.
Yeah, we recognized that as a potential problem when we sold the uranium business. And very happy to get that out.
Mm-hmm.
But elsewhere, you know, we dealt with it. And, we had a environmental department, and a fellow from UC Berkeley with a PhD, probably the most educated man in the whole company, ran that department.
Do you know, remember his name?
No.
Well, we'd get it.
We'll get it.
Australia, they were more concerned about air pollution, I think, and that wasn't a really a problem for you, they?
Australia, they were concerned about money. They didn't care much about it.
Okay.
Perhaps around the cities they did, but there was I think I told you that the Queensland government very rapidly settled on $100 an acre rather than having us do anything out there.
In the press, they seemed to
later we had to do something.
they seemed harder on the aluminum people in the press than on the coal operations.
Yeah, I think the aluminum people got in some trouble.
They had a harder time than you did, evidently.
The alumina.
Uh-huh.
And they had that. Planet Gladstone and gave us some problems.
So that sort of took the pressure off you, I guess.
Oh, I don't think, well, I don't know.
I mean,
we're way back in the wilderness. Yeah. Yeah, there weren't many people back there.
No. And you weren't putting much into the air.
No.
Or the water, I guess.
No water.
No. So,
no. No, we were just mucking up the surface of the earth.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And there wasn't anybody there to care about that.
Well, there were a few people. It was not an issue. But
no, no. No. We haven't mentioned Brazil at all. Did you have anything to do with the Brazilian operation?
Well, the Brazilian operations were.
It was Marcona.
And my involvement in Brazil, in the formative days of the activity there, was as a director of Marcona.
Uh-huh.
Chuck Robinson was the guy who led that foray. Marcona made the deal with Sumitri. Sumitri was owned by a Luxembourg steel company called Arbet. And it wasn't until Utah acquired Marcona. The Utah organization became involved.
And it lost a lot of money, didn't it?
It hurt, or hurt it did.
Oh.
The Marcona organization was kind of a peculiar one. It was headed by a guy who had an ego problem, Chuck Robinson. Had an ego a mile wide.
Hmm.
And I think we had a little discussion about how companies, how people take on the attitudes and of their superiors. What's funny about the Marcona organization, they kind of took on the Chuck Robinson ego-driven attitudes that really spoiled the company.
Hmm.
But I don't really want to get into that. I don't like to speak.
No.
Negatively about things. Anyway, yeah, Samarco was formed, a joint venture between Marcona and Sumitri, and therefore comes the name Samarco, Sumitri and Marcona. And Bechtel did the engineering. Built mine facilities. This was a hematite or ground the hematite, piped it down to the coast some 200 miles through what was then the longest slurry pipeline ever built to a pelletizing plant on the coast. And after, later years, I think Samarco became a significant significant profit contributor.
Mm-hmm.
After we acquired it. Charlie MacArthur headed up that activity for us.
Did you have dealings with this Brazilian?
Yep, sure did. Same sort of thing, you know, the provincial governors. While I didn't meet the president of Brazil, I don't think I did. It had a lot to do with the treasurer, the treasurer of Brazil. And Samarco employed a man who had been in politics. And had been to Brasilia, I guess, as a congressman from the state. Hesitant, trying to think of the name of the state. Well, anyway, hired him, and he later became
Minas Gerais. It's the only state I know of. Was this
Minas Gerais?
Minas Gerais.
Minas Gerais.
Okay.
And he was a Samarco employee for a long time. Then went back into government and was the treasurer, and then headed the Brazil Central Bank for a while. Mm-hmm. But since Utah came in, you know, later everything was formed, we didn't have an awful lot of dealings with the central government.
And the New Zealand operation was also under Marcona?
Yeah, that was a Marcona operation. I don't remember much about that.
Uh-huh.
It was not very significant.
And the shipping operations were Marcona?
Well, that was built on the shipping, transporting iron ore from Peru.
Mm-hmm.
Peru was nationalized, and that was a problem. After Marcona was nationalized, Robinson left Marcona before nationalization took place. When he decided that there was no hope, he got out. He abandoned a sinking ship and went to work in Washington for Kissinger.
Hmm.
He was Under Secretary of State for Economic Matters. That was it.
I'm going to switch. Okay.
And Marcona was about, after nationalization, Marcona had borrowed money to expand the plant, which was something that I found inexplicable. When you're under threat of nationalization, Robinson contended the only way to stave off nationalization was to keep spending money there, keep increasing one's investment. I didn't understand him. Being a junior on the board, I didn't have much influence on the decisions. Well, sure enough, it came back to bite us, because the mines were nationalized, and Marcona had debts to pay off, and no cash flow with which to pay off those debts. So it fell to Cypress in Utah, who were responsible for those debts.
Mm.
Cypress refused to pay its share, forcing them a buyout by Utah of Cypress' interest in Marcona. And that Cypress wanted out of Marcona, and that was the way they did it. And Utah, with its need for capital to continue to expand its mining operation, couldn't in any way be subject to a default on a loan. That was our view of the thing. So reluctantly, we bought Cypress out. We tried to sell Marcona to Cypress, but they wouldn't take it. By this time, there was nothing left of Cypress. It was just, I mean, nothing left of Marcona. And it was squarely operation down in the Bahamas, producing aragonite, something out in New Zealand that was not effective.
Was this just a question of strength, whether Utah bought Cypress or Cypress bought out Utah?
Sure, Cypress could figure that Utah liked a default, a loan default, much less than Cypress liked a loan default. So that's a game they played.
Simple question of who wins. Hmm?
Yeah.
And Utah won or lost?
No, we didn't win, we lost. We had to take over that. You know, and by that time it was going nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
I was opposed to the deal. I tried to get Littlefield to find some other way out, and he said, well, you figure it out. And I you know, we couldn't find another way out.
Hmm. Were you in on the, did you do that negotiating?
Yes, yeah. I've forgotten how we finally came to agreement on.
Who were you dealing with?
Henry Mudd, who was chairman of Cypress, and I've forgotten the name of the lawyer. Paul Allen was involved in the discussion. But that was just a kind of a minor sort of a thing.
Really?
The only real opportunity that, you know, the thing that Marcona had was this interest in Samarco.
Mm-hmm.
And when we acquired it, we put Charlie MacArthur in charge of the Samarco operations, or in charge of our interest in Samarco. Charlie is a fantastic metallurgist, and he got the pellet plant running very well, and that's when he started making money.
Mm-hmm. Well, did that recoup some of the Marcona losses
then?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. I think we finally, the time I left, we about broke an even on Marcona.
Mm-hmm.
Which meant that we had, oh, I don't know, I've forgotten what Marcona's debts were, maybe 200 million at the time.
Mm.
So we're talking about serious money now.
Mm-hmm. Was the shipping nationalized, or was that
a separate? Part, no.
That
no,
was a separate company.
We brought those ships in. We brought the vessel management into Utah.
Mm-hmm. And so that also was folded into GE?
Yeah. It wasn't folded into
or
GE.
Whatever.
Utah was kept as a separate entity.
Right.
When we were acquired by BHP, then shipping activity went into the BHP.
Mm-hmm.
BHP was much larger in shipping than we were.
Had GE had shipping?
No.
No. So this whole thing was new for GE.
Yeah.
Okay, well, that's another topic then. Okay, well, I think maybe this is a good day's work, don't you?
See, boy, we sure want to ramble all around the clock.
These are informal conversations, and they do ramble. But no, I think we've stuck pretty well to a timetable, and we're up now to where we can do the GE and then BHP. Want to be sure we got this. I guess Queensland is pretty well. Well, what about this? Maybe, let's save that for later, too. I was going to say about the strike at Queensland.
Well, that came out of the GE.
That was later, yeah. Let's call it quits for now, don't you think?
That's good.